Hey there, listeners. We do apologize. Mike had a little bit of a hot mic during this episode. We did everything that we could in post, but it still doesn't sound as great as we'd like it to. We didn't want to just scrap the whole episode because we liked it so much, and we definitely wanted to share with you. So again, we apologize and enjoy the show.
Well, it's Pareto's principle, right? What's the 20% of activities you do that produces 80% of the results? What's the 20% of capital and investment dollars that you spend that produces 80% of the results? And once you can figure that out, you can then stop pouring all the money back into the business, which is a risk in itself, because we know the odds of a business making it, you know, more than 5 years, more than 10 years, it's under 10%. You know, so once you can get to a point where you're taking a portion of what it is that you earn and putting it towards assets, I think that that's huge. And you can do that from a personal side where you buy assets, or you can do that corporately where you have your business buying assets. Either way.
And are we good on everyone else's audio?
Yeah, everything looks good. Yeah.
Does it work?
All right, I'll see you guys later.
That's melodic? How you start a podcast.
Aren't we melodic, you guys?
You know,
so harmonious.
I've been checking out all these different shows on Stitcher and the different podcatchers, and the openings for all the shows are music or it's some kind of beat. I like ours where we just test the audio levels. That was
cute.
I think that's how you should start every show. I want to welcome you, my friends, to Mike Up In Your Business. This is a show where we get up in, well, our guest's business. And today's guest is Justin Donald. He is the author of The Lifestyle Investor. You're going to discover, well, I think an interesting conversation around investing beyond in just your own business. So listen on in.
Well, let's get started. I want to start actually with a way that many podcasts don't start. Where can people get resources and learn more from you? So let's start with the promo of you as opposed to the classic at the end type thing.
Sure. Yeah. So, I mean, for me, it's pretty easy. You can go to justindonald.com and I have a bunch of different resources there. I've got a lot of free options. I've got an email list. I've got an online course, a book, a podcast, a masterclass, a mastermind, a private coaching experience. So I kind of have
massage. I heard there's a massage if you go early.
Yeah, definitely. If you go with the highest package, there's for sure a massage included. I can't for sure guarantee who it's going to be, but someone will massage you.
Right. And this is the book. I got it right here. I told you guys, I need a copy. I've just started to dig into it. So it's The Lifestyle Investor by Justin Donald. And I want to explore this because I think – here's what I hear. Tell me if you hear the same thing. Entrepreneur after entrepreneur says, I want to sell my business one day. That's my retirement fund. And they're not ready for that. What are the best ways an entrepreneur, a business owner can prepare for a retirement or just a comfortable lifestyle?
Yeah, that's a great question, Mike. And here's the thing. Most entrepreneurs have a bias for their business. So they think that it's worth more than it really is. And they're only sell it if they get that price, or they sell it, but because it's so operator heavy that they get tied in on an earnout, so they can't actually retire and they don't actually get the full payment, for, you know, 4 years, 5 years, 6 years. So there's a lot of things, or they just can't sell it. And so there's a lot of issues with that if that is their proverbial nest egg. So I think what's better is, I recommend this to entrepreneurs all the time, is to buy assets that produce income and get that income to equal what it costs you to live. So there are a few different levels that you can consider. There's your basic bare minimum. It costs me this just to survive, no lifestyle involved, like literally survival at the barest level, you know, ramen noodles.
But, right.
Yeah, but all your, like, you know, mortgage or rent, utilities, you know, true food, you know, mm-hmm. expenses. And then there's your expenses as a lifestyle. What does it cost you to live today? That's going to include maybe eating out and vacations and whatever you're currently doing. then technically, I don't talk about this a whole lot, and I didn't talk about this a lot in the book, but there's another level when you can cover the expenses of your business. So what happens when you have enough passive income to cover everything that your business requires? And what decisions would you make then? Would you make different decisions? Are there some decisions that you make because you're handcuffed to a way of doing it, or the security of knowing, you know, you put in X amount of effort or X amount of dollars and you get Y result and it's very consistent? Or would you actually delegate some things out, or would you find people to replace you? And so, you know, these are a few different, you know, levels of where you can get that passive income. And then ultimately there's total lifestyle, like ideal dream lifestyle income. And that's really fun too. But I've always found that when you don't have to hit the higher levels, when an entrepreneur has income coming in to cover what it costs them to survive or even their current lifestyle, it's at that point that they become comfortable finding operators that can run the business so they can take that first step of disengaging or at least not being on the hook and being a slave to the business that they built that probably was to provide them freedom, autonomy, lifestyle, all the things that it can strip from you if it becomes your master.
So, okay, so we got to unpack all of this. I do want to start at the entrepreneurial level. So what I heard is, can you get to a level where your interest income, or if that's the right word, a residual income through your investments is covering the operations of your business? And is that true? Is that what you said?
Yeah. That would be okay. One stage of it. I mean, I think I think your first stage is for sure your, you know, bare minimum expenses, which is going to be lower than whatever it costs to run your business. You know,
I'm just curious about the business part, and then I want to step back to the survival and the business aspect. If I can get to a level where my assets are paying for all the business expenses, that means the business doesn't need to sustain itself, really. I assume I'm paying the payroll of employees, I'm paying the rent and the heat and the products, materials I need. And if I don't sell a thing, the business can still sustain because the assets are paying for that, the interest in the assets.
That's right. And you're going to make decisions from a place of strength, not a place of scarcity or weakness.
Totally, right? Don't panic to sell. Yeah. I've never heard that. All right, so let's move back to survival. I strongly suspect many entrepreneurs, and I lived this way for so long, I felt I need every single penny this business was making just to get by. I couldn't put one penny away to start accumulating reserves, which ultimately would pay for themselves. How do I first start storing money away? How do I get past that mindset?
Well, I think it first starts, and by the way, I'm an entrepreneur. I've started companies, I've scaled companies, I've sold companies. Like, this is the life that I live for a lot of my career. So I get this, and I've been there, and I've been the person that invested 100% of my profits back into my business, feeling like I had to do that, that I needed to do that. And the reality is it was more conditioning than anything. You know, it was that I felt like I had some control, and therefore I was going to make a better return or a more controlled return by putting all my money back into my business. But the reality is my business didn't need all the profit that I made beyond, you know, what it cost me to live. It didn't need that. What it needed was for me to be calculated and to figure out what dollars are the most valuable. It's Pareto's principle, right? What's the 20% of activities you do that produces 80% of the results? What's the 20% of capital and investment dollars that you spend that produces 80% of the results? And once you can figure that out, you can then stop pouring all the money back into the business, which is a risk in itself, because we know the odds of a business making it, you know, more than 5 years, more than 10 years, it's under 10%. You know, so once you can get to a point where you're taking a portion of what it is that you earn and putting it towards assets, I think that that's huge. And you can do that from a personal side where you buy assets, or you can do that corporately where you have your business buying assets. Either way.
Okay. So let's talk about personally, and let's assume we're starting at a base of zero. I have no savings. I have no investments. I have a business that's generating some income that I'm living off of. Is there numbers? Is there a percentage I should start carving out? And regardless of what that percentage is, how do I start investing it?
Well, I think that, you know, one of the principles that I've lived by is saving 20% of what I make to be able to invest in something else. And the goal is to be doing that consistently every time there's a distribution or there's a salary payment or whatever it is. You know, most entrepreneurs are going to pay themselves a low salary and then have a higher distribution. And but it's taking 20% of that. And in the peak for me, I was taking 50% of that because I wanted to get really aggressive with what I was able to invest. So I think just part of it's like it's just disciplining those activities. So like if you think about the fact that when I first started investing, I was only investing like $100 a month, if even that, right out of the gates. But what happened was I developed this routine and this consistency of always putting money away. And so when I made more money then, or the business became more successful, it was easier to do. It wasn't like I had to fight so hard against myself and against the maybe desires that I have to have a better life now with this money and this instant gratification that I can experience today. And so a lot of it, I think, is just getting into the habit of doing it, even if it's at a small amount. Even if you don't think you can do 20%, maybe it's 10%.
Yeah, it reminds me a little bit of like why 401ks are such a great savings mechanism. It's because taking out before you even get your net check, and therefore you adjust your lifestyle off the net check, and you don't feel... what's the assets? I mean, do I go right into the stock market? I should be buying real estate. How do I know where to invest?
Well, I am a big fan of alternative investments. We can sum that up.
Massage parlors. I understand.
Yeah. Well, that's an operating business. So if it's capital, I mean, I like it, but yeah, you know, I have done some stock market investing. I think that there's a big risk if all of your or most of your assets are in the stock market because you never know when you're going to retire and what's going to happen. You know, what's the season of the stock market or of the U.S. economy? And you don't ever want to retire when it just had a big dip because you're not going to make that money back during the retirement years. So to have some money in the stock market, I think, is good. But I don't like to have an exposure of 100% or 90% in any single asset class. So I like real estate because you can depreciate it, which just means is a fancy way of saying you can deduct expenses to make it so that you don't really have to pay taxes or much taxes on that money. So you pay the most taxes on earned income, and then you pay the least taxes on passive income. And so that's a really good, you know, distinguishing characteristic of investments. I could also, you know, walk in the direction of debt investments. When you invest in something passively that you just earn interest on, that, you know, doesn't cost any work and you're getting some sort of cash flow. I like that as well, as long as it's collateralized or properly protected with more assets, twice as much assets as the original investment or loan amount. So that's kind of my rule of thumb. Like if something goes wrong, I have them on the hook for twice as much. So I should at least be able to get my money back. And then also the idea of investing in operating companies. And I think a lot of your listeners have expertise in different areas where they can diversify away from their company, but they can still invest in an area of expertise that they know really well. And that could be a great way to do it too, especially if you can negotiate like a revenue share, or you can negotiate like a quick return of the investment that you made. So you get all your money out of the deal quickly, and then you can reinvest it, but you still have equity and upside. So
I like that.
There are a lot of ways to structure it, and it really depends on the person, and it depends on their level of expertise. It depends on how much time they want to put into it. You know, if you want to put your time into owning deeded real estate, meaning you own that property, well, it costs you more time to manage it than if you outsourced it to a property management group. Or if you just invested directly in a real estate syndication where they professionally manage it and do all the work and you just show up as a limited partner with capital. So there's a lot of different things to consider when investing. And part of it is how much time do you want to allocate? What type of returns do you want? And how safe of investments would you like those to be?
It's interesting. I was about to ask you about real estate and the syndication. Why don't we go through each of these investment opportunities? And maybe you can tell me the simplest, most effective way. So stock. If I want to get invested in the stock market, what I'm hearing is don't go 100% on any one thing. I put a percentage in there. what stock should I be buying? How do I evaluate stock? Should I do something different than just raw individual companies? Like, how do I do this?
Well, the current stats show that actively managed funds compared to indexes like the S&P 500 index, that it's very lopsided, that only 5% of financial advisors or active managers who manage these accounts outperform just a simple index. So in other words, you spend more money to have them 95% of the time perform worse than an index that is the lowest cost vehicle in the stock market. So to me, if I'm in the stock market, I want to be in index funds. I want to be, you know, in something, a big category like an S&P 500, which are the 500 largest companies. I want exposure to that. There are other indices that you can look at. I mean, any of the newspapers or any of these, you know, Morning Brew or The Hustle, you know, any of these email newsletters that come out, they all highlight the major indexes that you can invest in. And if you want exposure to those, that's a great way to get exposure to a big sample size of companies, but for the cheapest amount. I just have an issue paying someone to manage my money to, you know, 95% of the time do worse than if I had just done it in these indexes, because they charge, you know, in many cases, 1, 2, or sometimes even above that in percentage. And that doesn't sound like a lot, but we're talking potentially, depending on how much you have invested and your lost opportunity cost on that money, millions of dollars.
Yeah. Okay. What about, like, just recently it was the GameStop stock exploded. So, you know, I talked to some folks like, oh my God, I was thinking about getting in. If I got in on Tuesday, I'd be a millionaire right now. I mean, there's a lot of this Monday night quarterback appeal or Monday afternoon armchair quarterback appeal to these things. How do we avoid the allure of that? Or, you know, are there opportunities that are so obvious we're idiots not to be grabbing onto them?
Well, yeah, it's so easy after the fact to say, I could have done this. I should have done that. I'd be rich if I had only made this move. But at the time of the investment, you only have a certain amount of information to be able to make a decision. And stuff like that is so speculative. It could have gone the other way. It eventually did go the other way. And so what if you did get in, but you didn't sell in time and then you lost all your profits? You know, that's just, that to me is more of a gamble than anything. And some people, they have that, you know, the tendencies to be able to do that. I don't. That's just too much exposure to me. But I mean, my goal is to not lose money and make good returns. I don't need to make the highest return on one single investment. So that's how I look at it. It's like, you know, how do I not lose money, but also make a good return?
So let's talk about real estate. You were talking about these syndications. That's new to me. When I was hearing, it's like, oh, buy a property and try to rent it out. What's the opportunity in real estate? And what if I don't have that much money? What if I have only $1,000 or $2,000? Am I negated from doing real estate?
Well, you're not negated from doing it, because you can always find a good deal, and investors are always willing to pay money, a finder's fee, for a good deal. So I have a lot of friends that didn't have the cash to actually invest in real estate. So what they did was they found real estate and brought it to a broker or two investors, and then they charged a finder's fee on that property. And after enough finder's fees, they then had money to put a down payment on their own property. So that's one way of doing it. But, you know, other ways of doing it is to partner up. So maybe you bring the deal and you find someone else that is the money, and maybe you operate it, or maybe you split the costs on operating it. So everything is negotiable in the world of investing and entrepreneurship. I mean, everything is. And so I just think that most people put these limiting beliefs, you know, on themselves and these blinders on their eyes, and they say, well, I can't because I only blank. But really, what I would encourage people to do is say, how can I? How can I invest in an asset that produces income? How can I buy some real estate, even though I might not have all the capital to do it? And that's one of my biggest regrets, is that I waited as long as I did, Mike, is I should have started probably a decade earlier than I did, but I thought I had to have the money to invest. And what I know today is that if I have a good enough deal, the money shows up. That's the easy part. And I didn't think it was the hard part.
That's awesome. And what about real estate right now? I'm seeing commercial real estate seems to be dropping, and the feeling is it's going to drop forever. And therefore, as it's dropping, is that a good investment? Or is there a way to be more selective to say, you know what, when you see a trend happening and people are moving out of the cities, going to the suburbs, that's the time to get in the suburbs. Is there a way to time this in the real estate market?
Yeah, I'd say yes and no. So when it comes to commercial real estate, I think that there are some areas that are going to be hit really hard. You know, I think co-working will probably come back, but in a different form than the WeWork that we saw, and with different models. You know, I'm invested in some companies that have a pretty unique revenue split with the landlords that I think that can stand the test of time. And it's just a more win-win all the way around. But in the world of like security clearance or, you know, certain industries where they have to show up, they're going to have to find office space. And so knowing what those are, I mean, if your client is Lockheed Martin or Bell Helicopter or Department of Defense or, you know, anyone like that, the Fed, FDIC, whoever it is, like, there's no way they can work from home. They have to have clearance. They have to go to an office. And in fact, what may end up happening is these groups have to buy even larger real estate or rent larger offices to adhere to the 6-foot rule. So it's interesting. So is it a slam dunk? No. Can you get good pricing on it? Sure. But you really have to be careful what you're buying. Your largest companies are still going to be needing it. You know, an Amazon that is expanding galore, you know, that they're buying warehouses like they're going out of style, or renting them like they're going out of style. So that's a great industry to be in, is distribution centers and warehouses. And that's on the commercial side of things. So a little different than office, but, you know, under that same umbrella. And I'm very bullish on those.
So I have a hunch in real estate, and I want you to tell me, you know, how can you play out a hunch and validate or discredit? Because I got to be careful. So my thought is, with people going virtual, this may rise second homes, or maybe a rise in second homes, because I think one of the benefits for the psychology of an employee was the fact you got out of your house, you went to a place to work, but now you can't have a place to work. I think some people are going to go crazy, work at home, but there's going to be freed up income, where maybe even the business will say, since you're not coming to the office, which was costing us $1,000 a month to have you there, we'll subsidize you $250 or $300 a month. I wonder if people are going to get these work cabins or remote locations just for the benefit of the psychology. So that's my hunch. Oh my gosh, vacation homes or cottages may start increasing significantly and on a sustained basis. But I don't know if that's true. That's just a belief I want to believe to be true. How do I validate when I have a hunch like that?
Well, that's a good question. I think the first place to start is asking as many people as you can that specialize in that space. And this is number one, ask people that specialize in single family home sales and single family home rentals. Secondly, talk to anyone that is on the executive team of bigger companies that may have a budget for something like that, or maybe allowing for people to stay at home. I mean, a lot of these companies may say, hey, we just saw this huge surge of profit. We got out of our corporate lease. We're not going to spend this extra newfound cash on, you know, people having another place to work when they can stay at home. Whereas you might have other people that, you know, other organizations that are like, hey, what a great use of our funds if we can help people, you know, help our employees buy real estate. So I think that one is probably, I would want you or many people to do a lot of vetting on that. That one is an idea I haven't heard yet. I'd have to give it some thought.
that makes me nervous.
Right? It's interesting. But at the same token, I mean, you might have single family home purchases rise for other reasons. So let's say that you try your theory out in a really hot market like Austin, Denver, you know, places that people are moving to right now that they were even before COVID, but now are coming in even larger droves. Well, you might have that work out not for the reason that you thought. So I love investing in places where there's like multiple outcomes for success. And my theory's not correct, maybe I still win because of other, you know, situations.
Tell me about the debt investing. You said you have two types of assets. I don't even know what debt investing is. What is that?
Well, you can look at this in a few different ways. So number one, a lot of people that want to maybe redo their home, or maybe they want to rehab a home and flip it, they might not be able to get lending, traditional lending from a bank. They may not be able to get it as fast as they need. So maybe they have the ability to get a loan, but it's going to take them 45 or 60 days to get it, and they need it in a week to be able to buy this house in cash and then start doing some of the work. And so there's an opportunity to be a private lender or a hard money lender where you can collateralize this investment with their home that is worth more than the loan dollars that you're giving them. So if anything goes wrong, you just take the home. And so in a situation like that, you want the second best outcome to be that they honor the contract, but the best outcome that they default because your return is infinitely better. You're not hoping that they default, but you want that.
To protect yourself that way.
So that's one way to do it. Another way to do it, and by the way, in that situation, you become what's called a senior debt holder or a first lien holder, meaning you're first in line to be paid back if anything goes wrong. So I like debt for a lot of reasons, because when you invest in debt, you are first to be paid back over anyone who owns equity in that business. So you're at the top of the stack. And then if you're senior debt, you are number one of that debt stack. So let's say, for instance, there is a fund that you invest in where they, you know, this group maybe pools money and does a bunch of loans for real estate or does loans for operating companies, and you can collateralize that loan with two or three or four times the value of those dollars. So you're protected and you're in the first position, a senior debt position. There are a lot of funds out there doing this in many different industries. One of which is, you know, that I do a lot of work with is in the cannabis, hemp, and CBD industry, where they can't get traditional loans anyway. A bank can't lend to them because it's not federally legal. So they have to rely on private lenders, groups. And that's a great source of getting good returns. You can charge really high interest because they'd rather pay a high interest rate than give you equity in their business that's growing, you know, 25% per quarter.
Yeah, I love that. Tell me about operating companies. You said, you know, you can get involved in with somewhere where you have expertise. It sounds like investing in another small business, effectively.
That's right. Yeah. So, you know, there are ways that you could invest for equity. You could be a debt component and maybe get an equity kicker, which is like free equity. You're giving them a loan, but they're giving you equity for free. I negotiate those all the time. That's very common practice for me. There are ways that you can invest in a company with an accelerated distribution schedule. So I have often invested, let's give an example of a $100,000 investment to buy a business as part of it. You know, that's part of the dollars that this group needs. But I negotiate that maybe I get 80% distribution of the profits until that loan or that investment is paid back. So I can get my money out of a deal within a year. I still have equity, so I still have upside. I can still get distributions and cash flow, but I can take that same $100,000 and invest it in another deal and do the same thing all over again. So now I have two investments with the same $100,000 and equity in both.
Interesting. All right, let's wrap up on this. I'm going to share what you would do in this circumstance. And it's real simple. We're going to go in increments, $100, $1,000, $10,000. So you get your first $100, knowing everything you know. What would you do if you only had $100 to invest?
I'd probably put it in an index fund and let it accumulate over time. There are crowdfunded websites, though, where, I mean, like Fundrise and Diversity Fund and CrowdStreet and Peer Street. And you can do as small, and some of those is hundreds of dollars, where you either get in on the equity of real estate or you get in on a debt play on real estate. So you could do that as well.
Okay, awesome. Now you have your first $1,000. Maybe it's the exact same, maybe it's close enough, but what would you do with the first 1,000?
Yeah, well, 1,000, I'd probably be in the same place. You know, maybe you're diversifying over a few different deals. So you use one of these crowdfunded platforms and you get into two different deals, $500 a piece.
Gotcha. Okay, Now we're getting to a bigger number. So you get your first $10,000 in savings. I got this cash. What do you do with it?
Well, now you get to the point where you could buy a single family home and you could negotiate a smaller down payment in, you know, maybe a market that's not super nice, but if you're doing it as a rental, it doesn't need to be. It just needs to be a market that's going to hold its value. You know, it doesn't have to be okay. A gorgeous home.
Okay. First $100,000 cash. You got it. What do you do with that?
So here's where you could upgrade on real estate. I mean, part of why I like real estate is because there's some intrinsic value. It's not going to go to $0. There's value in it no matter what. So even if all goes wrong, you're not going to lose all your money like you could selecting a stock, or you could in, you know, GameStop or something like that, right? I mean, you could literally lose all your money in that. You're not going to lose all your money in real estate. So I like it for that. But at the $100,000 mark, you get a lot of opportunities for different debt investments where you could get into funds that have a $100,000 minimum or a $50,000 minimum, and you could do one or two different ones. So that's where that can get really fun if you don't want the responsibility of owning your own real estate, if you want to put no time into your investments.
I like that. And let's talk about the entrepreneurial lottery. You get $1 million in savings. You still have your active business. You got $1 million of cash. How are you investing that?
Well, this is where entrepreneurs need to be careful, because many of them are going to want to take that full amount and roll the dice on the next business. That's a very common thing. I mean, I coach entrepreneurs on how to buy assets to produce cash flow. And just because someone is good at running a business and entrepreneurship does not mean they're going to be good at investing. So I'd say you need to find people that are having success. You model those people. You find a peer group that is one that's going to be very uplifting and knowledgeable. And you really diversify that investment over a few different things. I probably would not put $1 million into one investment unless it's just an area that is so much of an expertise for an individual that it's really hard for them to go wrong. Otherwise, I'd probably say, you know, $4,250,000 investments or $10,100,000 investments. And it could be spread out over real estate and debt and maybe part of it into an operating company.
Justin Donald, the author of this book, The Lifestyle Investor. Why don't you pick up your copy right now on Amazon at your favorite bookstore. Justin, thank you so much for joining me today.
My pleasure. And can I share one other thing about the book?
Yeah.
So all the proceeds of The Lifestyle Investor all go to charity. So there's a group that I'm supporting called Love Justice International, and they stop human trafficking around the world. There are 17 locations. So all the money that, whether you go on Amazon and get it, or you could go to my website, to lifestyleinvestor.com, and I'll actually do something for your audience where I'll give them the book for free. They just have to pay for shipping. And still those proceeds are going to go to Love Justice International as well.
Oh, that's awesome that you're doing that. We'll include the links. We actually do a post roll after this with our team. We'll make sure to share that link there. Justin, thanks again for joining me.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
All right. So, what'd you all think?
I think I'm very bad at financial.
Right? I know. I was thinking the same thing too. And you know what else I was thinking? I was thinking, what did he say, that 95% of the time your money managers are really not doing too much for you, and you'd be better off with your money just in the index market?
Yeah,
and I
That
which made me feel better, because that's what I
do. You do index funds?
Yeah.
I found an index fund. I think it's VOO. But whatever. It doesn't matter, because there's multiple out there. But you can't invest in the index. You have to find something that emulates the index. So I found this stock traded one called VOO, which is a fund. And so I went in on that. But also he has me super concerned about, I have a wealth manager, it's Ron Greenberg.
Yeah.
I'm like super concerned. Like, he's not the 10% that's going to beat it. I mean, he's great. But
I have a wealth manager too. And I was thinking the same thing, like, not that I would know what to do. So I feel completely
index fund, you should do the index fund. You know what I liked most was when we went, I said, okay, you have $100. What would you do? I thought that was just interesting. I thought $100, he would say, like, put in your safe. Or the fact he had strategies for every level, I thought was particularly interesting.
Yeah.
That's good.
And I also think it's a critical point when he said, even if you only have $100 to invest, the important part is getting in that habit and choosing your sort of future lifestyle above having a more extravagant current lifestyle.
Current lifestyle. I also appreciated hearing an exact percentage of how much mm-hmm. you should be putting away, the 20%.
Yeah.
Like, put that away, like knowing exactly, giving, being given an actual guideline of what you should shoot for was helpful.
So I have a friend, I won't share his name. I'll give the initials JB. And that's also his name. He called me and he goes, he just found a huge amount of money. I won't get the specifics, but what he did was his first job, he set up the 401k plan and he left after 6 months. So he was there for a very short period, but he contributed to it. So I don't know what the dollar amount was, but say a couple $1,000s. It, over 25 or 30 years since that first job, maybe it was 40 years, it's big time six figures.
Mm.
And he totally forgot that it was available to him. It was like a windfall. And that, to me, that was like, wow, there's proof. Time investing now.
Yeah.
Can't rewind. So invest today. The returns are always higher in the long run. So it was right. really fascinating.
That's awesome. Yeah. So awesome.
Does anybody else get like anxious talking about this stuff? Like I felt listening to it. I was like, oh my God, I need to invest more money. Oh my God.
I know.
Yeah. I'm never going to survive.
The 20% part is when I was like, loser, check. Like, 20%. What are you talking about? Like, I think especially for Kelsey, and my generation, it's if you went to college and you paid for it, it's extremely been extremely tough to put any amount of savings away at all. Brutal.
That's actually interesting that the repercussions, how they're reverberating down. Is this right? If you're paying those college bills and you can't save, it's going to compromise your future life significantly. But then the other question is, if people weren't paying their college bills, would they be saving anyway?
I mean, I definitely would be. I was paying $500 a month 6 months out of college for it. Now it's been 10 years.
And still paying.
Oh yeah, I owe not a whole lot, but I'm around like $12K.
Still,
it's ridiculous.
Yeah.
Are you doing the 401k?
Yeah, I have to. Look, I'll just tell all my financial information to everybody. My bank account number is.
I need the routing number.
No, yeah, I'm going to. I was actually waiting because I was in a unique spot with that, with the rollover and everything. So,
Right. You have a rollover. That's great. What about you, Amy? Are you doing the 401k?
I haven't done the 401k. God. I know Christopher's like, let's just do the 401k for your company too. I'm like, yeah, okay. But I like my paycheck.
I know.
Yeah, but that's.
He's like, Amy, we're just being stupid if we don't take advantage of the 401k. And I'm like, I know.
But your paycheck.
But I really love my paycheck. Yeah.
But when you get your paycheck, it's after taxes.
Exactly. So
here's the fascinating thing is if you do the 401k, that's pre-tax. Right. So it'll reduce your gross pre-tax. You will have money taken out still for taxes, but it's a lower amount. So say you put $100 every paycheck into the 401k. It's not like you're going to have $100 less. You may have like $60 less.
That's true.
I don't know what the number is.
Right. Right.
But the impact isn't nearly as big. And the funny thing is we adjust so quickly.
Yeah, we don't miss it, right? If you get used to what that is, yeah.
Yeah, and you may even get a raise at some point. You're working pretty well.
I may.
Yeah. So
maybe in a few more years we'll give you a raise.
Something. Yeah. I hope you do. I really hope you do it.
I'm going to do it.
Hey, he just said, I really hope you do. I really hope you get a raise at some point. I really hope you do. Yeah.
Do it. I really do hope you get a raise too. And I hope you do it.
I hope you earn a raise too.
You know,
I was reading in Dan and Chip Heath's book, Switch, they talk about this concept of the elephant and the rider. And the rider is the person sitting on the elephant. That's our mind making the appropriate logical decisions. But the elephant is the emotion, right? So the logic is I want to do a 401k. The emotion is I don't want to take a reduction in my pay. And the elephant is a million times stronger. So they said, how do you redirect it? And one technique is by setting defaults. And they said, if our default for our company is you opt in to the 401k, you have to make that choice. Other programs are set up, I don't know if we can do this, where you have to opt out of the 401k. So you're in it by default.
Gotcha.
By simply switching it, people are like, oh, the effort to opt out is a pain in the ass. Let me just do it. Right. And the success rate's way higher.
That's so smart. That's really
organizational.
Like I mean, two things. Some of the best advice I ever got was regarding putting money away for future expenses. One of the gentlemen I used to work with, he never had a car payment ever in his life. And I said, how did you manage that? And he said, well, he was like, once I started with my first car that I paid for monthly, then I would never use that money for anything else. I would just allocate that for the future car. So once that car was paid off, he just pretended that money wasn't there. And then he would hit a threshold. And then when he needed a new car, that money was there for the new car. And then the other thing was, I actually worked, when I worked down at the casino, they had a really good 401k matching plan at the time, which is really hard to find now. And it's stunk because I just couldn't take a full advantage of it at the time.
Mm. Yeah, I just encourage people, if you have 401k, to leap in at the max percentage, even though you can't afford to do it, and then you have to find a way. And then it kind of settles in 6 months later, and you're like, oh, this is easy. And then the money starts just piling up. I also, I like the real estate investing. I'm really intrigued and interested in that. I like that. I always thought I had to buy a property. I'm like, that sounds daunting. I don't know how to do it. I can't afford it. But it's like, oh no, there's these funds basically. And that sounded super appealing. I subsequently have looked into it, and I have a friend who does exactly that. Ah. They move 100 or 50 partners, whatever it is, go in and they all put in their, say, $10,000 times 50 is now they have, was that 500,000, right? They do, right? 500,000. Now they can buy something with it. So it's just interesting that these things really do exist. And he said the return for him, the years in and years out, and the numbers are different, but then those dollar amounts, but the percentage returns, he said, are between 10 and 15% per year for his investments. I'm like, wow, that's pretty.
That's awesome. And I liked when he made that note that passive income gets taxed less than your earned income. I feel like that's a good thing to keep in your mind in terms of how to financially plan for the future.
All right. Well, we have it on record. You two, Amy, Jeremy, have to do the 401k.
Yeah, we do.
I'm not sorry.
Mike, congrats on your micro slumlord future. You got there.
Yeah, thanks. I got a place you might be interested in. Micro slumlord. All right, do we have a game for
tonight? It's an investment quiz. This will really test you guys.
Let's do it, man.
Okay, so question number one is, what information can you find in a mutual fund's prospectus?
Oh, we get those all the dang time.
I know.
I think
I
no, literally, I get them at the office all the time.
Do you really?
And email.
Oh, I thought you were kidding. Right?
Yeah. Yeah. No.
Okay, so A is the
do I look at them though?
No. That was a shame.
A is the fund's fee structure. B is the fund's historical returns. C is the investment objectives. And E is all of the above.
What do you get
in the prospectus?
What was the third one?
The fund's investment objectives. All right.
I mean, isn't the objective always the same, to make money?
Make money.
Yeah.
Not lose your money.
Yeah.
Well,
maybe not lose money.
Yeah, like imagine here's a strategy, guys. Normally we like to make money. We're going to try something different this time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, question two. A 25-year-old who invests $100 per month and sees that investment grow 6% per year will accumulate $138,000 by age 60. Which of the following scenarios would result in a similar portfolio balance? A 45-year-old who invests $200 per month until age 60, so $200 per month for 20 years or 15 years. A 55-year-old who invests $480 per month until 65, so $480 for 10 years. Or a 55-year-old who invests $1,990 per month until age 60, so a 5-year period.
What was that?
$138,000.
No, but it's 25 years old.
A 25-year-old who invests $100 per month and watches the investment grow 6% per year by age 60. Yeah.
Oh, how old? So it's 45, 55, or 65.
It's 45 to 60, 55 to 65, or 55 to 60. But the amounts were all different. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Okay, I got you. I got him. Yeah. Okay.
Okay, and then question three is...
Such disgust.
This one's really easy.
Kelsey.
Over the...
I feel like we should make a rule, no math test.
Yeah, no math.
I'm going to throw some algebra in, but yeah.
Oh, my God.
Over the long term, what's likely to be the better investment? Stocks or your home?
If your home's in New Jersey, it definitely ain't the home. If you're in Austin, though, my God.
Yeah, yeah. Right? It's blowing up. It's been
Texas
blowing up
and Florida
for a long time
are
now.
Like going crazy right now. Okay, what information can you find on a mutual fund's prospectus?
All of it.
All of it.
All of it.
Yes,
I did
all
of
it,
too.
Of it, yeah.
Woo-hoo. I know it's robust, so that's why I went with that. Yeah. I open it, I'm like, oh, I don't know.
Oh, this is robust.
Yeah, robust.
Too much words.
There's inches of words here. That's too many.
Literally, like that envelope that you handed me before, Amy, that's what that is.
That's what that was. Oh, yeah.
That's crazy.
I don't like them.
Okay, question two. A 25-year-old invests $100 per month and sees that grow 6% per year, will accumulate $138,000 by age 60. Which scenario would result in a similar portfolio?
I said the 55 to 65-year-old.
Yeah, I said that $1,990.
That's what I said, that, which is different than what Amy said. Amy said $400.
Amy said $480. A 55-year-old who invests $480 until 65. It is a 55-year-old who invests $1,990 until 60.
Oh,
so if you invest almost $2,000 for a five-year period, then you will have that same balance. But
well, I ran the math, though. That's $24,000 a year times 5 years. That is a little bit over 100,000. The return is extremely low. That's
exactly.
All principal.
Exactly.
Yeah.
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 But the 25-year-old is only putting away 600. So it's 24,000 a year versus 600 a year. And the 600 person is making the exact same amount. So it just proves start early.
Yeah. The interest is crazy. Yeah. And then finally, over the long term, which is likely to be the better investment, stocks or your home?
I'm going with stocks.
It is. It's stocks. Yeah.
I did better than I thought.
Me too.
Two out of three, man.
I get 3 for 3 too.
3 for 3. I only got 2 for 3, but still, that's better than I expected.
Yeah, for reals.
There was a press release. I got to look and see if this is mythology or true, but supposedly Warren Buffett offered at a class that he was lecturing at or something, he offered that any student that he would give them on the spot, I think it was $1 million, if they were willing to give him 10% of their income for the rest of their lives. And everyone declined it. Now, the thought is, you know, 10% of your income, if you grow in your career and stuff, that you'll make, you know, 20 million or something like that. My thought was, regardless of the numbers, if you're the one person that Warren Buffett invests in, like the PR, that is worth millions and millions. Like,
yeah, but it's not even that. I wouldn't even think that. I think it's more of a factor of cost over time, like you said. Like, if you say, hey, I want $1 million now, and you invest that properly, that's going to out
start investing that, and you start compounding interest.
Yeah, so that's a great point, right? You could take $1 million, you invest it, you say Warren's backing me, you're a billionaire. So I don't know if that's mythology. I'll tell you what's not mythology: rating the show. We need it. We'd love it for you to do. Go to rateourpodcast.com. Please give us an honest rating. It supports us. And please subscribe, because I think that supports you. Also, if you have any questions, email me, askmike@mikemichalowicz.com, and we'll answer on an upcoming show. Thanks for listening in to Mike Up in Your Business. Wishing you good times.
Wishing you good times.